Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
And I'm Kevin Batchelder.
And our guest today is bioethicist Dr. Gregory Pence, whose brand new book is all about the ethics of cloning, focusing mostly on how cloning has come into the mainstream with the popularity of Orphan Black. And I am very, very happy that Orphan Black has given him a platform with how to explain all this clone stuff to a wider audience. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So how did or did the appearance of Orphan Black on our television screens change the way you talked to the layperson about the ethics and the side effects of cloning?
Well, I've been doing bioethics for about 40 years, and I lived through the brouhaha and tempest in a teapot about test tube babies, where people were very misled about, you know, what would happen if sperm and egg met outside the womb. And so when Dolly was cloned in 1997, I was kind of irked when some of the same people, like Leon Cass, made some of the same arguments that the sky was going to fall if we ever originated a child by cloning. And but one of the difficulties I had is that we have been so profoundly conditioned by everything in movies and television and literature that everything about cloning is evil and terrible, that it's very, very hard to overcome that. Even the language here is you have to be very careful. You know, you talk about an army of escaping clones. That's very pejorative. So when Orphan Black came along, it flipped everything for the first time, because it showed normal women, you know, doing normal human things that weren't zombies, and who had a life and had personalities. And it was a wonderful teaching moment, I thought.
And how has the popularity of the show, the amazing acting of Tatiana Maslany, how has that helped people understand what you're trying to explain to them?
Well, it certainly helps that she's an amazing actress. I mean, I think she's been gypped a couple of times for Emmys. And I must confess that watching her, I sometimes think I'm watching different people. And it is... Let's just pause for a minute and just to emphasize what an amazing kind of acting it is, because you not only do you have to show different characters, but also show how they share something in common at the same time. And that is no small thing to pull off. But the nice thing about the show, I think, is that there are so many myths about people originated by cloning that the show just completely does away with. And it's kind of like when the first test tube baby was born and there was a color picture, that was all everybody really needed. The mother, Leslie Brown, would walk down the streets and people would be afraid of her pram because they thought like a little monster from Gremlins was going to come out and bite them. And then all of a sudden they saw her child and they said, oh, it's just a baby. And I think Orphan Black is doing the same thing, is showing real people struggling with just really a different way of being originated.
Now, I'm curious, for someone like yourself, when you first started to hear about the show, wondering how true it might be for someone who has such a strong background, was there a bit of a discovery for you or a appreciation more than some other movies or things that might not have dealt with this as well in the past?
Well, I have two confessions to make. One is that I already watched a lot of other shows, and I was getting to the point of show burnout in terms of how much time in my life I could watch shows. And secondly, I had been burned so many times before about shows that portrayed human cloning that I was a little bit skeptical. So many shows like Alien Resurrection or The Sixth Day have cheated. So I was, when I finally got around to it, and various of my students and colleagues kept, you really ought to watch that show, you know. I was very pleasantly surprised, especially in the first two seasons. And especially about how it seems to me they really tried to get the science right. And that's unusual, I think, when it comes to cloning.
Yeah, that's what we as viewers who don't have the background often wonder, is just how true or realistic is some of this being. So that's the fascinating side for me, is hearing from someone who has the experience like yourself.
I mean, the only thing that's not true in my experience is that they still portray all the scientists as a kind of, like a James Watson arrogant, kind of guy who has to be brought down in the end. Because I don't really know anybody like that. Most of my science friends are very normal people. But I guess that's just something you have to have in a show that has dramatic value.
And that was going to be my question. How does the portrayal of the scientists at the Institute and everything, how does that translate to the comparison between the Hollywood mad scientist and the people in the field who are actually trying to work within the ethical boundaries in this field?
I think this is one of the continuing tragedies of our time, that I mean, all the scientists I know are really good people, and they're almost boring. They're so good. They're not really that dramatic at all. But God, try to think of, I mean, I give this challenge to my medical students or undergraduates all the time. Tell me a movie where the scientist is the good guy. And usually they struggle. Even, sometimes I'll say Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I say, well, he's an anthropologist. I don't know if he's really a scientist.
That's a stretch.
Yeah. And, it's really hard to think of a couple of movies where the scientist is the hero. Contagion or The Day After, but, there's a lot of cases like Boys from Brazil or Jurassic Park and Jurassic World where, the scientist clones someone and something bad happens and he's got to be brought down, killed by the dinosaur in the end, the T-Rex. That's the way it kind of works out.
Well, I'm actually having a hard time finding something specific to cloning where the scientist was the good guy.
You could look a long time, and I doubt if you're going to find anything. And that's kind of why I had a kind of epiphany when I actually read The Island of Dr. Moreau, which I had seen two bad movies on it, but I never actually read the book. And it is a fascinating book, and it is fascinating to me that it's so prominent in the show, because, it's the mother lode of every bad thing about scientists and science fiction. And it's early, way before Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that a lot of people would classify that more horror than science fiction, depending on your taste these days.
Well, and it had so much stuff in it so early, 1896, that the whole thing about border crossings, sewing animals and humans kind of together, and impatience with results, and Mother Cody, he's off on an island far away where there's no IRBs or ethical oversight. It's amazing how seminal that book really was.
So coming into the world of Orphan Black, what particular episodes or incidents have stuck out in your mind as things you would like to show, point out as examples to people of, here's a situation we have to deal with actually in real life?
Well, one interesting thing, I'm actually giving my students a free copy of the book at a seminar now, and one of the things that's kind of mind-blowing to undergraduates, and just because people don't know, it's the point of a professor is to teach people history so they don't repeat it. When they think of eugenics, they all think of the Nazis in Germany.
Mm.
They do not really know what happened in the United States and Canada. In fact, I didn't really know about some of the stuff in Canada until I started researching this book. And they certainly didn't know that some of the racist talk about immigration, which we hear now in the presidential campaigns, was implemented as public policy. And there were massive amounts of involuntary sterilizations going on.
It was in the 20s, right?
Yeah, the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924 was when it was national, but basically for the next 10 or 20 years, anyone who had a feeble-minded look, you know, like Carrie Buck, she was going to be sterilized. And that, I mean, the other thing that's amazing, that continued in Sweden until the 60s and until North Carolina for black welfare women until fairly recently without their knowledge. So these are not just science fiction things. These are real things that really happen to American people.
Yeah, I believe there was a involuntary sterilization program on several of the Native American reservations until the 70s or 80s.
That I don't actually know about.
It's scary when you think about how much of this is about fear and control. So you talk about people making clones of themselves for various reasons. You have some people wanting to control the clones, some people wanting to destroy them. And you come back to the ultimate question, how do you define life?
Well, that's also where the thing about synbio comes in. It's kind of interesting, right? The synthetic biology. Mm-hmm. You can actually create life out of chemicals, and that's kind of an interesting question right now in biology. I think it's partly semantic as to what counts, you know, as chemicals that you're starting with and what counts as life. But yeah, those are, you know, it's interesting to me that as a, you know, originally I've trained as a philosopher before I became a bioethicist, that so many of the questions in talking about terrorism or the economy or biology are actually philosophical, but they're not often explicitly identified as such.
Part of the science fiction fan in me when I started reading the synthetic stuff was going, oh dear, is this step one to us creating Cylons?
Yes. Oh, that, yeah, I remember Battlestar Galactica and the Cylons. That's a great reference. You know, the sad thing is that I'm at a school where there's a ton of pre-meds and a lot of biology courses. And most of the biology courses, they don't talk about things like global warming or cloning or mitochondrial transfer, you know, the interesting stuff. That's considered like fluff. And so there's certainly a place for someone to talk about this stuff to the general public. I think actually, just to make a kind of plug for bioethics, is that somebody... You know, doctors are reluctant to talk about a lot of stuff, biologists, but somebody needs to talk about the interesting stuff.
It sounds like we need to get a petition going to get you to hold your own TED Talk.
I don't know about that. So one of the things that I found pretty interesting was I've taught here 40 years. I've had several sets of identical twins, and I think I bought into what's called by psychologists the twin mystique, that twins are always each other's best friends, and it's really kind of interesting when the parents dress them alike, and they sit together in school, and they have similar girlfriends, and I never realized how sick that can be. And what a burden that puts on the two or the three kids, especially if one just assumes that the other will always be their, you know, their best friend and live next to them and tell them everything, and the other tries to break away as a singleton and have an authentic identity, you know, alone. There's a whole literature of the problems that twins and triplets have trying to separate. And it's very relevant to some of the things that might be happening in Orphan Black, I think.
I wonder if that's why we have such a popular subculture of evil twin movies.
It is a very deep theme in the literature, and it's perfectly understandable how it happens, because when the there's a psychologist who was a twin herself and has twins and specializes in treating twins. And she talks about three kinds of closeness: one, codependency, enmeshment, and authentic friendship. But usually when the more healthy twin tries to separate, the other twin can get quite nasty. And there have been cases in real life of one twin killing the other or assuming the other's identity. And then if you go way back with primogeniture, the first twin down the chute got everything and the second twin got nothing.
Wow.
So that created some bad feelings too. And in Native American culture, the second twin was always considered evil. So there's a whole, you know, pedigree of this stuff about twins. But one of the things that really struck me, there's a festival every year in Twinsburg, Ohio, where twins come together. And there was this one women who were about 30. They went one year and they said they were just stunned that there were like twins in their 70s and 80s who had never really had any other friends or really ever had a relationship, because it was just assumed that they were always going to be each other's best buddy, and they never were able to establish a separate identity. And this particular set of women who observed this, they immediately went back and said to their parents, "We're going to move apart and try to separate." And the parents had a really hard time with that.
Oh, wow.
And it's often the parents who are the real sickies. They'll, like, you know, they'll talk to the kids with one name, like Keith and David. Keith and David, come here. Keith and David, go out. Not even naming them separately. Mm-hmm. And the parents get a lot of secondary game when they go to the mall and the kids are wearing, you know, the same clothes and everybody's ooh and awing. So this was a real insight to me that not everything is happy in Twinland.
So you can imagine how complicated things get when you discover you've got 15 or 20 identical cells.
There would be some things like with the casters where if you were raised kibbutz style, you could pretty much tell from social psychology that there'd be a certain kind of dynamic that would occur where someone would be like the leader and someone would be like the contrarian and another one might be the peacemaker. It would almost be inevitable, I think, that that would occur.
Wow.
Now, I'm curious to hear, talking about the show and a little bit here, where you're going, as you were watching, we had the first couple of seasons with just the female clones.
Yes.
Were you, as you're watching this, thinking, well, it would be more fascinating if we also bring in some different sets of males? I mean, did you kind of see that coming from a, you know, your point of view?
I didn't see, well, two things. I think the female clones are much more interesting than the casters. The casters to me are more like a stereotype of the, that you see in novels like Citeen, where there's a military clone that's bred to be a warrior, and they're all pretty much the same. This is more, gets into the subhuman kind of clone trope that where, you know, they just sort of mindlessly obey. What I do think would be interesting is if we had another set or a pod of clones discovered somewhere. Hopefully they might be brown, say in Brazil. Maybe they're even young, maybe they're 8 years old. And we see the effects of a different culture, and maybe they have to be rescued by the leaders and casters working together. I don't know, but I think it would be interesting to bring in another ethnic identity. Of course, Tatiana Maslany couldn't play those but I'm sure there's a talented young Brazilian actor out there somewhere who could. But I think probably the most fascinating aspect about the whole cloning subject for a lot of people is the, you know, the nature nurture debate, and how much, you know, we're who we are is due to our genes, and how much, and, you know, by having the same genotype raised in different places of different surrogate mothers, I think Orphan Black makes that point wonderfully, that who you are is only partly the genes you inherit, but also how those genes were raised, and it, you know, more technically it gets into epigenetics and the range of expression of the genes, but you can just see it in the show. that, these are really different people, even though they obviously all have to be about the same height and about the same IQ. It's also interesting that they're of different sexual orientations.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And as far as I can tell, and this was the hardest chapter to write in the book, because almost every fact is in play or contentious in some way. But I do think that very small differences affecting the embryo or in gestation, in terms of hormones and exposure, and can affect how people are attracted later as adults. And there's a good deal of evidence, I think, for that. But it's a contentious area. You've got to be real careful of your language and how you say it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see that. Yeah.
So what other challenges or changes would you be interested in seeing in upcoming seasons of Orphan Black? I know you have a whole chapter dedicated to this in the book, but there's got to be more than five.
No, there were 10, but Leah Wilson, the editor, cut it down to five. And but I do think you have to project some of your own wants here. I would like to see Rachel redeemed, and one way she could redeem herself is by sacrificing, either her life or an organ to save someone else, maybe Cosima. That would be very powerful, I think. They should all be able to donate to each other very easily. So that shouldn't be a problem. I'd almost be shocked if this doesn't happen. In bioethics, there's something called, I don't know if you've ever heard the term, a savior sibling.
Mm-hmm.
There was a famous case called the Ayala case, A-Y-A-L-A, where a couple created a child to be a donor for an existing sick child. Jodi Picoult's book, My Sister's Keeper, is kind of about that kind of case.
Yeah.
So this would be a very natural and scientific thing to happen in Orphan Black.
I think there was another movie where a boy discovered that he was conceived only to be a bone marrow donor to his sick older brother, but that brother died before he was born. So there was a lot of resentment towards him from his parents. I can't remember the movie. I really can't.
Well, and of course there's the island where they're all.
Yes.
there's a couple of novels that are basically have the same thing. One was Japanese. But all of those novels, especially, the idea of a spare parts twin, basically assume that you can create a human being and then murder him for his parts. And usually the sort of hidden assumption is that not really a human being, he's just some kind of organ cadaver. But as soon as you get around that and start thinking that whether you're a person, doesn't really matter on how you were originated, then you realize you can't just murder people for their parts. And quite a lot of scripts, I think, would go out the window at that point.
Yeah, but this is a very, very heady show, and I'm very happy that it inspired you to delve deep into this topic, because like I said, the book is very deep in some places, very fascinating in others, especially where you bring in a lot of the clone behavior
Also, I know this is a show about science fiction, but sometimes the science is more fictiony than the science. I mean, take the case of the Chimera. I had my own little clone club helping me with this book, and we started researching. One of the girls came in one day and said, there was a real case like this that really caused the mother, all kinds of hell when she was accused of welfare fraud because her babies didn't match her DNA, and she was accused of stealing somebody else's babies And the obstetrician, you know, testified as well, I don't think she stole the babies because I saw them come out of her. I was right there. And it turned out she was a chimera. And that's why her babies didn't match. And it was actually a lawyer on the other side, you know, a good lawyer, who actually pointed this out and cleared it all up. But who would have thought, you know, that such a person could actually exist?
Wow. Because that was pretty much the premise of that TV show Dark Angel, where the children were genetically engineered with DNA from various animals. And the lead character, who was played by Jessica Alba, had feline DNA merge into her. So she had some cat-like traits, including improved vision, improved agility, some other things. But they were all of her brothers and sisters were genetically engineered to be super soldiers. And then one day they got sick of it and escaped as teenagers.
Well, a little bit of science can go a long way sometimes.
Yes.
I think you could actually do a whole course just on bioethics and science fiction. And, you know, you would talk about Contagion and Gattaca and Orphan Black, and you would have a pretty good course. And then, you know, the other thing here is John Dewey, a famous philosopher of education, said that you have to start with young people where they're interested. You can't assume they're interested in what you're interested in. And I think Orphan Black is a very good way into the minds of especially young women interested in science, because a lot of my campus is full of pre-meds, and they're, a lot of the young women are really fans of Orphan Black, and it's just a good way to introduce some of these issues that, you know, otherwise might be a little bit not so lively to them.
Combining science fiction, science, and pop culture in order to teach higher scientific concepts.
Yep.
That, I would sign up for those classes.
You know, I know a lot about pre-meds because I've taught them for 40 years, and so many science courses in college and high school are people going in and they read PowerPoint slides to the kids who have to memorize. It has gotten so bad. Mm-hmm. And it is just mind deadening. They for kids who like science, they almost kill it, you know, because you wouldn't believe how much text they have to memorize. And they don't teach these kind of things in those courses. So it's kind of like you're keeping a little flame alive, you know, in the darkness. And there's more than one way to get people interested in philosophy. I had a little epiphany. I was in Vienna last summer, and there was a big bookstore downstairs, the best bookstore, and it has a huge English language section. And one wall was philosophy. And I was talking to the manager, and, you know, the books on Plato had dust on them. Most of the traditional philosophy books, no one had moved. But there were books like on Homeland and philosophy or Orphan mm-hmm. Black philosophy, and they were moving. You know, we're selling a couple of these a week. And you know, when you travel around the world, those are the kind of books that people are buying. And I thought, you know, I'm going to try one of these with bioethics, and you know, because, you know, you gotta get people where they're at. They might think that philosophy is too, you know, esoteric or dull for them. So you got to kind of reel them in, you know.
No, I remember I actually own a Battlestar Galactica in philosophy book. And there's actually two of them talking about philosophy in The Matrix. So I'm right there with you.
Oh, I think The Matrix is an amazing show, especially for all these problems about Descartes' evil demon and how do I know I'm not a brain in a vat? And it's a great way of approaching that. In fact, I think if I were teaching an intro philosophy course, I'd probably start out by showing The Matrix. I remember I raised this question once, and a little kid came up, and he was obviously very troubled. And he said, you know, maybe there are certain questions you really shouldn't ask. I had got to him, I think.
I was going to say, yeah, once you expand that mind, it doesn't go back to that size anymore.
Nope. And we need more of that. We definitely need more of that.
You know, that, God, what if I ever bring to that? You know, I love it.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Dr. Pence.
I just point out that I'm a professor. I'm not a real doctor. I'm not a doctor, so I wouldn't want to impersonate anybody.
Well, Professor, we appreciate your time today. The book is What We Talk About When We Talk About Clone Club, Bioethics and Philosophy in Orphan Black. It's out from Ben Bella Books on March 29th. Where can people find you online in case they want to ask you some questions or read more?
They can just Google me, Gregory Pence. And we're also just about starting a Tumblr site. It's going to be called Orphan Black and Bioethics.
Okay. We'll have people keep an eye out for that, and we'll have links to them as soon as they're up. Again, thank you for your time today.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Kevin.
My pleasure. I'm always interesting.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pohl, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
Ah, yes, where science fiction, pop culture, philosophy, and just general geeking can collide. I need to do more interviews like that one. Hopefully we have another one coming up. Next week's show, I think you'll really love. Comics creator, staff writer, and just general writer provocateur, Brandon Easton, will be on the show next week, and honestly, I think if we had time, I could have talked to him for 2 or 3 hours. We were just trying to go deep into all sorts of topics, and there literally wasn't enough time in the day to cover every little topic we hit on. So, but to finish up with the what we talk about when we talk about Clone Club discussion, don't forget, Orphan Black starts next week, April 18th. I'm having a time dilation slip. This is probably from my embarking on a 12 Monkeys rewatch, but it could also be from me getting older. Who knows? Either way, we have some more fun interviews coming up. I'm working to get people from Stitchers, people from 12 Monkeys, people from Winona Earp, and even Hunters on the show. So keep an eye out, or just keep listening to the show for that. Anyway, that I don't have any TV talk, any additional TV talk, other than, wow, a lot of people were really angry about the season finale of Sleepy Hollow. Ouch. As far as I can tell, Twitter didn't break, but it kind of bent a little bit, warped the frame under the sheer number of people who have said on Twitter, and just on Twitter, that they are now canceling the show because of the turn that the show took in the season finale, should have some executives at Fox a little concerned. I don't get it. People make story choices that are tough, that are there to create drama. I understand that. But some choices are just mind-boggling because it makes no sense to destroy the chemistry of a show that people love. Not like that. Anyway, I will let the Sleepy Hollow experts and those who have said they're going to abandon the show continue to argue that, because it's not my argument. I do understand their pain, though, because we've all gone through this. And sometimes the only way to get through it is to see what they do next with it. And then if they can't recover from the changes that they make, if the story doesn't improve, then, yeah, get rid of it from your DVRs, move on to something else. It seems like you can't be a genre fiction fan and enjoy certain types of shows without people not understanding how genre fans feel, how, I don't know, because if you play too much to certain expectations, the show gets boring, but then if you shake up the show too much, you lose your core audience. Isn't that what happened with X-Files the first time around? Who knows? Maybe they'll figure it out. It's too late to fix it from what they're saying, but maybe they'll make it work. Maybe they have a plan that's actually not a half-assed one. It will be interesting to see how many Sleepy Hollow fans tune in next season, if there is a next season. But yeah, I can empathize with the, I'm gonna go with unfathomable decisions in writing genre fiction, because against my better judgment, I went back and watched the final episodes of season one of Shadowhunters, and picking up episodes 8, 9, 10, and 11 were actually improving. They were, the story solidified, the quest became more plausible, or the secondary quest became more plausible. The characters acted like seasoned warriors and grown-ups. And then in the last two episodes, they went back to being whiny children making bad choices. And I wanted to punch a wall, because I was this close to putting a positive addendum to my initial five episodes in review. And then the last two episodes completely, I mean, this is like fourth and 40 and you whiff on kicking the ball. It's like the pitcher throwing a knuckleball with the bases loaded and one out, and the catcher can't handle it, rolls all the way to the backstop, everybody comes home, game over. Seriously, what in the... And this is how much I love genre television. I am ranting about the missteps of a show I know I'm not going to watch anymore because I'm angry that they broke the story. They broke it. They completely broke it. They dropped it from the fifth floor and watched it shatter on the sidewalk. Oh my goodness, I'm so angry. Anyway, I will probably have a few more tidbits to drop about upcoming TV shows, upcoming movies, as soon as I start watching them. Yes, Kevin, Winona Earp is on my list. And for those of you who are enjoying Winona Earp, Kevin's got a podcast. Of course he does. It's the Winona Earp podcast. I don't have the link for it. Search Kevin Batchelder's Twitter timeline, at KBatchelder. You'll find Winona Earp mentions all over the place. Give it a listen and enjoy the show. But that will do it for this episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. If you have any questions or comments, please call in. The number is 602-635-6976. That's 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message or record a voicemail message yourself and email it to me, summer@sliceofscifi.com. Head on over to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a rating. Tell other people how much you're enjoying the show. The more you rate, the more you review, the more iTunes love we get. And that's a good thing for everybody. Check us out on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. Check us out on Google Plus, Slice of Sci-Fi. And as always, the websites, sliceofscifi.com, plus other playgrounds like writersafterdark.com, kickassmysticninjas.com, itscomicbookday.com, and the new non-100% genre site, popculturegeeks.com. Thank everybody for your donations and your patronage, keeping this show online and running. If you want to help contribute, keeping the websites online, keeping the media for the shows online, please visit the website patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Follow the links. And every pledge helps, literally helps pay the bills around here. Again, thank you to my good friends over at SciFried for providing the music for the show. You can listen to more of their music over at sci-friedband.com. And if you like the music you hear, let them know. Tell them Summer sent ya. But that'll be it for this episode. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.